Hello, everyone. Hope you didn't look right into the eyes of the eclipse, or if you did, yeah, this is an audio podcast. This doesn't bother you too much anyway. So Mitchell Lee and Brandon, too, welcoming you back to another edition of Press Play Action here on Jersey Nerds Productions. And Brandon, we continue on with our Quentin Tarantino marathon. It's good eating here today, as it's Inglourious Basterds and it's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Brandon, first of all, did you see these in theaters, or were these first-time watches for you right now?
I mentioned last podcast, I saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood like 5 times in theater or something like that. So
it was a first-time watch for you right now?
Yeah, this wasn't a first-time watch for me. Inglourious Basterds, I don't think I saw in theaters, though. I think I saw it outside of theaters.
Neither did I. This movie, I remember summer of 2009. I'm very much a rule follower. I'm like, you know what? Rules are in place for a reason. Let's follow those rules. But in 2009,
that's shocking to think of coming from you. Just rules. Don't bend the rules at all. A rule follower. I'll get
colorful inside those lines, but I'm not gonna go outside the lines.
Don't go outside the lines.
But in 2009 and 2010, there were movies that I wanted to see before I turned 17. They were in theaters. And so I'm like, all right, we're going to check them out. But I think that the movie Bruno scarred me so much as a 15-year-old. I was just not ready to see any of the things that I saw in that movie. So I kind of like hung back a little bit, and I missed out on Inglourious Basterds. And it was also mid-August, and so it wasn't in the summer where I had more time. I had football practice every single day, so I didn't have the time to go to the movies the way I did in the summer when, like, The Hangover and District 9 and, you know, Transformers Revenge of the Fallen were coming out. And I missed it, and I saw it about maybe 3 or 4 years after it came out in theaters. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was a movie I saw twice in theaters. So I saw it once, and then one of my good buddies, Eric, who I know is a big Quentin Tarantino fan, just kind of came into town, and I'm like, all right, hey, new Tarantino movie came out. You want to check it out? I loved it, and we just watched it, and it was a good time. But I was not on the same wavelength as everyone else when it came to Inglourious Basterds. When I first saw it, I said that it was, I think I gave it either a B or a B minus. I was in one of those two camps. Was not a particularly big fan of that movie, although there were things I liked about it, for sure. With any B or B minus, that's a fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. But with anything we talk about on this list, I'm not going to let the opinions of dumbass 18-year-old Mitchell stand. No, he's dead. We're going to talk to 29-year-old Mitchell and see what he thinks about things, and also 29-year-old Brandon, because, hey, Brandon saw this back in the day, might have changed his opinions as well. But before we get into our thoughts and opinions about the movie, let's tell you, for those of you who don't know, they're like, Mitchell, I clicked on this again, I'm blind because I looked right into the eclipse, and I don't know what this is about. Please let me know. what the hell is Inglourious Basterds? Those are just two strange words put together. And you're kind of right. Obviously directed and written by Quentin Tarantino, and released on August 21st, 2009, starring Brad Pitt, Christoph Waltz, Michael Fassbender, Eli Roth, Diane Kruger, Daniel Brühl, and Melanie Laurent. This had a budget of $70 million, and it made $321 million worldwide. Great job, Quentin Tarantino. $120 million domestic, $200 million international, and it opened big. $38 million, which was his biggest opening at the time.
Nice.
And this movie is about, takes place during in Nazi-occupied France during World War II, and it's a plan to assassinate the members of the Nazi high command by a group of Jewish U.S. soldiers, as well as a theater owner, and her vengeful plans to take out the leaders of the Nazi party in Germany while they're in France. And Brandon, I said that this movie was one I was lower on. I did not get the same hype that everyone else did, especially considering that this is a movie that is so highly regarded. I mean, you look at it on the IMDb top 250. We're working our way down this thing, and this is number 70 on the IMDb top 250. So it's got a pretty prominent position. Also on Letterboxd, it is the number 91 movie. So everyone loves this movie. Everyone's high on it. And I watched this movie, and you got room for one more, because I have to join the bandwagon. This movie took my breath away. I don't know what the hell was wrong with 18-year-old Mitchell. I don't know if I got hit in the head with a baseball bat before I watched this. I don't know what the deal was.
You got hit with the bear juice.
I got hit with some like stupid gas or something, because I don't know what happened, but I must have been watching a different movie. What I watched, what Quentin Tarantino was able to bring to life with Inglourious Basterds in 2009, let me tell you, Brandon, this movie was awesome.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm going to let that sink in a little bit. It's awesome. Like, it's just a kick-ass movie. Like, I don't really know why you would dislike it other than you dislike the violence and the revenge plot. And if you dislike that, then I totally get it. Like, the movie's not for you. Right?
I think I know what it is. And this, Brandon, we're going to answer your question from the last few weeks. Mitchell, why did you group these two movies together?
Okay, go ahead.
You know, you grouped Kill Bill 1 and 2 together. Yeah, that's obvious. Jackie Brown, Hateful Eight. Those are kind of the Tarantino movies that no one really talks about. Reservoir Dogs, Django Unchained, you know, humble beginnings, highest budget.
Can I guess?
Yes, you can.
You're not going to say, like, you know, I really have an appreciation for Brad Pitt now or something like that. Like, you're going to be like, oh, I really like Brad Pitt. Like,
well, I've always liked Brad Pitt, but it's not because of Brad Pitt, no.
Okay.
It's because of the first five words in the name of the next movie we're going to be talking about, Once Upon a Time in. These are both basically fairy tales, violent fairy tales, but fairy tales, because in glory and light spoilers, but this, and we'll get to deeper spoilers later, but these movies do not follow, you know, factual events. These movies are more of what we would have liked to have seen happen in this particular circumstance.
100%.
Inglourious Bastards literally starts with once upon a time in Nazi occupied France. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood ends with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So I like to kind of view these movies as like spiritual, like sequels in a way, because they are very similar in that they do not follow what happened, but not in the like conspiracy theory type of way.
Yeah. It's like an alternate timeline. Almost.
Yeah. It's like, more
this
like
is what could have happened.
It's not even necessarily what could have happened. It's more of like, man, wouldn't it have been better if it went this way instead?
Right, right.
And this movie opens up.
Yeah, go ahead. I was just going to piggyback off of that. Like, even talking about, you know, the rich people you meet in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Like, nothing is, like, truly factual about. There's some facts involved, but most of it isn't factual. It's most like, oh, like, this star and that star and whatnot. And you can kind of think of the same thing with Inglourious Basterds. Like, the Nazi high command that you meet is technically the real people, and like, it's portraying real people, but it's kind of like, this is an alternate like event, or like an alternate timeline of like what could happen. Or like, this is, like you said, this is how I would like to see this like play out. So yeah, continue with, cause I think the opening of Inglourious Basterds is one of the best parts of the movie, per se.
There are a lot of people, and I don't know if I would put it at, like, number one, but
right,
it's high.
It's close.
There's
it's
a close. Lot of people that would put the opening of this movie up there as the greatest opening to any movie ever. Yeah. And, hey, if you're making a short list of top openings to a movie, this has to be on there. This opens up with... It opens up on a dairy farmer in France, and Christoph Waltz's character, who's known as the Jew Hunter, which tells you everything you need to know about him, he's coming, and he is suspecting that this family, this dairy farmer, are hiding the last Jewish dairy farm family in the area. And he comes in and he talks to this this guy, and you know, he's smoking a pipe, drinking some of their fine milk, and just kind of, I don't want to say sweet talking him, but just kind of, I don't know, luring you in just a little bit, talking a little bit more, like almost friendly, like, hey, you know, if you help me out with this, you'll be met with reward and all this stuff. And you don't ever really get the vibe that things are okay. Things are just tense. And you can tell that this guy is trying his best to keep his composure. But the second that things flip, and they flip, where Christoph Waltz basically just says, all right, do you have enemies of the state hidden underneath your floorboards? And this guy does the right thing in that situation. Or I don't say the right thing, but in that situation, it's basically like, if you're asking that specifically, you know what the answer is. That didn't just come out of nowhere. That came right, because you know.
He knew before he got to the
dairy. Exactly, yeah. Yeah. He knew exactly where they were and exactly how to get this guy to break. And Christoph Waltz, and this is a scene that immediately you come in, and this was Christoph Waltz's first Hollywood movie. He did a bunch of stuff overseas. I want to say Austrian. And we almost didn't get Christoph Waltz in this movie. Do you know who was considered to be the lead for this movie first and foremost before Tarantino said, yeah, no, I want a European in this role?
I do not, but it'd be interesting to hear who you say it is.
Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh, that would have been nuts.
You say it would have been nuts, but I can't imagine anyone other than Christoph Waltz playing this role. And yeah, Christoph Waltz, from the very second that he comes on screen, you're like, oh, I understand why he won the Oscar for this. And he won the Oscar, and it was a runaway. No one else was even close.
Yeah. Do you
only think... Oscar this movie won, by the way.
Yeah. Well, that's...
we'll get to that.
In of itself later. Is just absurd. But, I mean, if we don't get Christoph Waltz in this movie, then we don't get Christoph Waltz in Django. And we don't, you know, we don't get the rolling, almost working with Tarantino doing those type of roles. So I do appreciate the fact that this is his first role with Tarantino, and then we get, you know, other roles with Tarantino later on.
I did some research, Brandon, because we talked about Christoph Waltz with Django Unchained and how he won an Oscar for that. Christoph Waltz has won 2 Oscars in Quentin Tarantino directed movies. Brandon, how many other actors do you think have won multiple Oscars with the same director?
It would have to be Tom Hanks, right?
Nope.
Is it not Tom Hanks?
Tom Hanks won an Oscar then with Jonathan Demme and with Robert Zemeckis. So
then it's Spielberg with somebody else, I would assume. Nope. Right? It's not Spielberg. Oh. I don't. Yeah, go ahead. Give me the nugget.
The first one was back in the 30s, so Walter Brennan as the actor and William Wyler as the director.
Okay.
And then you've got Jack Nicholson with James L. Brooks.
Oh,
Jack Nicholson won for As Good As It Gets, and he also won for, why am I blanking on the name of the movie? My God, it's the one, I want to say it's about... Nope, I will get to this 80s movie. Terms of Endearment.
Okay.
Yep, Terms of Endearment and As Good As It Gets.
We thought a name, but yeah, that makes sense. Terms of Endearment.
So those are the... Christoph Waltz and Quentin Tarantino joined those ranks when he won for the role of Dr. King Schultz in 2012. So this is literally an actor and director pairing for the history books that began with this scene. And my God, is it a way to begin a legendary pairing.
Yeah, no, it's a great scene, and I think, like you were saying earlier, now that I like have seen the scene multiple times, I don't know, I just can't picture anyone else doing it better than Christoph Waltz. And I will give like the rest of the people involved in the scene credit, but I mean, it's his scene. Like, he takes it over, grabs it bull by the horns, and just like runs with it. And I mean, what an opening to a movie. And we'll get into more spoilers, but I mean, what he does in that opening scene and the what he commands almost of the camera at that moment is just really spectacular. Like, I think it's better than anything he does in Django, to be honest with you. Like,
I actually think his role, I like him in Django better. And I know that I'm in the minority when I say that, but yeah. I just personally think that his role, I mean, they're both so good, and he definitely deserved the Oscar roles. For both of those. So no fraudulent wins as far as I'm concerned, even though I love Leo in Django Unchained and might have given it to him instead. Either of them taking home a golden statue, fine by me. But once that scene ends, well, at the end of that scene, we see a girl running out from underneath the floorboards, covered in her dead relative's blood, running out from the house, and it's shot through this doorway, which makes it look like a horror movie from the 70s, which I really appreciated, because I think that was,
or like the
That was a good vibe to go for this scene, because the score also puts you in that mood as well. And she's running away, and it's Shoshana Dreyfus, who we will come back to throughout this review, played by Melanie Laurent. Who, welcome back, Melanie Laurent. We talked about you with Now You See Me, and we're going to talk about you in a much more positive light in this review. And Christoph Waltz doesn't go after her. She's running, and he kind of has his gun pointed at her, but she's way, his gun's not going to be able to reach her. Not that gun that he had. I don't think that's going to be able to reach.
It's like a Luger pistol, right? Yeah, it's like a Luger.
Exactly. So that wasn't going to be able to reach her. So he basically just lets her go. And then we roll right into the next chapter of the movie. And it's 3 years later. And we meet Aldo Rain. And this guy, Brad Pitt, was the only person that, at least from what I've seen, the only person that Tarantino wanted for this role, and he is so good. I don't know how he didn't get nominated for an Oscar for this.
It truly
blows my mind. I don't get it at all. I can't explain that one. Especially, I've seen Invictus. I like Invictus. How did that's Morgan Freeman, not Matt Damon, never mind. But Jeremy,
I was about to say Matt Damon in Invictus is like winning an Oscar.
No, but the best actor nomination went to Morgan Freeman as Nelson Mandela, and there are people that literally that think sense. Morgan Freeman is Nelson Mandela, which I'm not gonna lie, is a tad bit racist, but he was very good in that movie, so I kind of understand.
He was very good in that movie, yes.
And we'll get to the movie that took all of Inglourious Basterds Oscars in a moment, but you meet this guy, Aldo Rain, and he's recruiting Jewish American soldiers to join the Bastards. And this guy is just chewing scenery with his mouth open. The way that this accent that he does, it's tremendous. It's funny.
What is he going for?
You hang on. It's like this Tennessee accent thing. You hang on every word that he's saying. It's great. He's giving this speech about how Nazis ain't got no humanity and they need to be destroyed. And it's like, all right, I just like the way he says words, like destroyed, and we're gonna be doing one thing and one thing only, killing Nazis.
My favorite is Italian.
We'll get to that later, but yes, he's talking about I want my scalps, because everyone in my command takes on debit. Debit, you owe me personally. And he wants 100 Nazi scalps from every single person in his command. And they're going to be cruel to the German, and they're going to be cruel to the Nazis, and they're going to fear them. And it's just like, all right, it gets the mood set. Yeah. You're 100% on board with Brad Pitt and Lieutenant Aldo Rain after the scene of him just talking to his new recruits.
Yeah, you're 100% bought in like the first 2 minutes. You're right. Okay. Yeah. This is Outer Rain, and he's commanding his revenge. I mean, it's kind of, it's such a weird plot in terms of like Jewish Americans, like basically forming like a special ops group to like kill Nazis. They're Nazi hunters is what they are. And so it's just like interesting that like that's where Tarantino goes with it. But it makes sense because it's like, oh, well, like in your head, you're like, that's like a cool like storyline kind of. Yeah, but it's just interesting that that's kind of where it goes.
He has so many lines in this that just are perfect.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Okay, after the introduction scene, you learn about a few of the other members, like Hugo Stiglitz, who was a German sergeant that was just going around killing Nazi officers, and he was in prison.
Just flipped on a dime and just started killing Nazis. It was like,
And so the bastards were like, hey, we know you're in prison right now. We're breaking you out because we're a big fan of your work. And then Donnie Donowitz, known as the Bear Jew, played by Eli Roth. And this is the casting that makes me go, thank God he wasn't available, because he would have fucked this movie up. I've liked him in some more dramatic movies, but I don't think Adam Sandler would have worked for this role whatsoever. I just don't see it.
As Donnie Donowitz?
As the Bear Jew, I don't see it. I don't think he has the physicality for it. Eli Roth's kind of like a big dude. Like, think that him with the baseball bat is terrifying.
Yeah, you know who I think he could have played? I think he could have played like Wiki or
Dominic DeCoco.
Dominic DeCoco. I think he could have done that. Yeah, I think he could have done one of those. But no, I think the casting is really well done. Like that's my thing, is the casting is just like awesome. And you were talking about that line where they're like, we're a big fan of your work. I like when he's like, we were thinking if you wanted to like join us from the minors to the Pro Bowl. Like, you were going to upgrade your work to pro ball. You know, we were just trying to see if you're ready to join the major leagues. It's like the major leagues of Nazi killing. Like,
right after you get that flashback of them, they run into a group of Nazis and they're they're like, all right, you need to tell us everything that you know. You know, but there's this group of Nazis coming up. We need to know when and where and what all they have.
Right. And we don't get ambushed.
Yeah. And there's this one guy that's just like, I respectfully refuse. And the great line of, Donnie, we got a Nazi here that wants to die for country. Oblige him. Just every single thing this guy says, you hang on every word. And then Eli Roth comes out and beats this guy's head in with a baseball bat.
And you see it on screen. It is.
It's not as brutal as I thought it was going to be.
Right.
Watching it back, it's not as brutal as I thought it was going to be.
Totally.
But given the fact that it is the head of a Nazi, I mean, no one's sitting there, like, no one's like, oh, I'd love to hear from his perspective. You know, like, that's not really.
Yeah. I mean, it's still seeing a character's, like, head get bashed in on camera. But I do see your point. Like, no one's feeling sorry for him. Like, it's what people need to grasp from this movie is Tarantino is basically saying, like, they are Nazis. They don't get mercy. Like they don't get a second chance.
They ain't got no humanity.
Right.
They need to be destroyed. he lays it out for you at the beginning of the movie, Brandon.
he does. He 100% lays it out. And I mean, look, if you get squeamish about like violence and like, you know, looking at guys
getting
scalped.
Don't watch Tarantino movies.
Yeah, don't watch Tarantino movies.
Yeah, but stay away from this director.
I mean, right, exactly. Because, like, to me, honestly, this most squeamish part was, like, the scalping. Was, like, them,
yes.
The scalping is squeamish to me.
Yes.
Personally.
But, and we'll get to that a little bit later, even though there's a scene where they basically just want to leave one guy alive who gives them the information they need because he sees someone else's brains get beaten. He's like, shit, they're going to be here, they're going to be here, they're going to be here. This is how many weapons they have. This is how many people they have. I don't want that to happen to me. But, hey, now when you get home, are you going to take off that uniform? And they're like, oh, yeah, no, we can't have you taking off that uniform. We need something that you can't take off. And they carve a little swastika into the guy's forehead basically as a – you let everyone know that we're coming type of thing.
Right.
And from that point, we then transition to, and my lovely fiance Sarah made a great point about this movie. She thinks that it should be called Shoshana and the Inglourious Basterds, because as we had with Shoshana earlier, this is just as much her story. We talked a lot about the Bastards so far. They're not in this movie as much as I remembered them being in it. There's a lot of Shoshana and kind of another character that we'll get to here in a minute. And she is, she's changed her name to Emmanuel Murnau, I want to say. Something along those lines.
Yeah, Murnau.
And she runs a French cinema. And Joseph Goebbels, who was kind of the head of making Nazi propaganda films.
He was the marketing director for the Nazis, you could say.
Yes, yeah, basically.
Propaganda. Propaganda guy.
They're trying to find a place to have the premiere for their newest film starring Frederick Zoller, who was a sniper that killed, I think it was 81 men. And they were just basically like, shit, you want to come and play yourself in this movie and kind of get out of the sniping business and get in the movie business. And he's in this movie, played by Daniel Brühl, which I watched Rush about 2 or 3 weeks ago and then watched this. Daniel Brühl just needs to be in more things, period. But right. You hate him in this movie, not because he's like going around and you don't see him really being cruel to anybody. But he's just like that guy that won't take no for an answer. You know, he starts hitting on Melanie Laurent, and she is telling him every which way possible, leave me alone. I don't like you. Not because of anything. You're just a Nazi and I don't like Nazis.
Right. Right. Well,
and dude, just,
we know why she doesn't like Nazis, but yeah.
Yes. But she's keeping that close to the chest. She's not letting that out, but, she kind of like plays along with it because she realizes what she can get out of things. If she kind of goes along and agrees to have the premiere set at her cinema, where she also is in the same room with Hans Landa again for a little bit. And there's kind of a back and forth where you're supposed to wonder, first of all, does Hans Landa recognize her? Now, do you think that he does or do you not?
I definitely think when you talk about when Hans Landa sits down with her and starts talking to her.
Yes.
Yeah. I 100% think he knows who she is.
I do too.
Oh yeah. Cause he even goes like, give her a glass of milk. And I'm like, dead giveaway. I was like, dead giveaway.
I think at the end when he was like, nope, I completely forgot what I was going to ask you. He was just messing with her.
Yeah.
He was playing with his food.
I think what it is that he knows, like in the back of his head, like he was given a job to like hunt Jews and kill Jews. But in his mind, he's like, I've already destroyed her life. Like,
I'm off the clock right now.
Right, right. I'm off the clock. Like, I don't need, like, I hate to make like a joke about it, but like, that's what they were doing. They were like, your job is to do this. And he's like, I'm off the clock. Like, I'm not here to hunt her. Like,
I'm having cake right now. No, right, I'm having strudel right now.
I'm just
going to
make a scene and be like, oh, you're actually a Jew. Like, I'm going to drag you out of this place and like you like shot in the head. Like, he's like, it's just not worth it. So,
like, cool.
I do like, this isn't, like you were saying, it's not factual. It's not like down to the facts, like about like the characters involved, but like, you know, Goebbels is like portrayed decently well. Like I think Landa is portrayed well in terms of like that was what a Nazi would feel like. And so I think Tarantino does a good job again of like sucking you into the world and being like, yeah, this is like Nazi occupied France. And like you definitely feel like you're in that environment while watching the movie. And I think that again, credit to him, that's one of his best things he does, is he just kind of, you know, is able to world build and kind of get you into the story as quickly as you can. How do you feel about Mike Myers being in this movie? Like, that's random, isn't it?
I was going to say that was one of the things that I did not like about this movie.
That's fair. Mike
Myers,
this was random.
Mike Myers is a fucking talentless hack, and I do not like him whatsoever.
I shouldn't have said anything.
So the Love Guru came out the year before this. And if you were to ask me, would I rather be stabbed in the eye or watch the Love Guru again?
Okay.
I would think about it, but I would take the stabbing of the eye.
Okay.
Because it is legitimately one of the worst movies ever made. And the entire time he's on screen in this movie, Mike Myers looks like he's not taking shit seriously. He just looks like he just stepped right off the set of the Love Guru. And it pissed me off.
No, that's fair. I will say maybe his character's not supposed to be serious, but also, yeah, I like Mike Myers, so I'm not gonna lump myself in like the I think he's a talentless hack, whatever you just said. But yeah, there are some weird like people just pop up randomly in this movie, and I guess that's what I was getting at, is like there's some weird like random pop-ups and stuff like that, but I think it all works together as like a story in the end. And yeah, it's just weird. There is one scene that's like kind of completely separate from the rest of the movie, but it connects the two. Well, it connects the two groups together, but it's like it's not a scene that like you would really think about. And I was talking about the bar scene
where they're like in Fassbender.
Let's
talk about that without getting into spoiler. We'll kind of save some of the last parts of this for the spoiler talk, because I think that once you start getting down the road of the Fassbender scene, then you start getting into heavy spoilers. That scene. I think that's the scene that I don't remember being anywhere near as good as it was. That scene is so tense. And just like the beginning scene in the movie with Christoph Waltz, that's like a 20 scene. This scene takes time to build its tension. That is something that Tarantino does expertly in this movie. It's not wasted motion. Everything feels crucial, vital, and it feels like it all leads somewhere and ties up in a way that isn't, you know, crowd-pleasing, satisfying like a bow, but it's like, I can't imagine putting pen on paper and coming up with something better than that right there. And you made this movie feel like something that you would watch in the 40s or 50s or 60s.
Right.
It feels, especially as it goes further along, it just feels like a movie that's always been around, if that makes any sense. It doesn't feel like
it
came out in 2009. This feels like a timeless movie.
Yeah, I guess my point with that scene is kind of the movie just like slows down and like kind of, it doesn't stop, but it just slows down and it lingers for like 20 minutes.
It's these guys playing bar games.
Right, exactly. And it's
leading to something.
Right, exactly. It's just very interesting that he kind of uses that as like a tool to like lead it to something else. And yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, like the ending is like wild. It's crazy. I mean, it's
the ending of this movie is satisfying on a level that I didn't know that. Well, I guess up to this point, I wouldn't have known that Quentin Tarantino
is satisfying.
Yes.
The like last scene is absolutely amazing.
It's very similar to the ending of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and very similar to the ending of Django Unchained, where you just go, I can't imagine things turning out like I couldn't have put pen to paper and made it better than what it was right there. And you did such a great job. We will get to specifics with the non-spoiler part, because trust me, there are plenty of specifics in both of these movies to talk about. Before we get to grades, I'm going to cover some of the Oscar stuff.
Go ahead.
Because this movie was nominated for 8 Academy Awards, and it won one.
That's
Christoph Waltz.
Yeah,
it was nominated for Best Film Editing, lost to The Hurt Locker. It was nominated for Best Cinematography, lost to Avatar. I do kind of understand that one.
I agree that one. I don't think cinematography is like the strong point of this movie, to be honest with you.
I really liked it, but again, Avatar was just like a...
Yeah, that's what I'm kind of getting at. It's like Avatar was like another level.
Best Sound Mixing, lost to The Hurt Locker. Best Sound Editing. This is back when they broke up sound into two. I wish they kind of did that still. Sound Editing, The Hurt Locker. Best...
There seems to be a
original
theme.
Screenplay. Say it with me now. The Hurt Locker. Best Director, Catherine Bigelow, director of The Hurt Locker. Best Picture, lost to The Hurt Locker. So The Hurt Locker.
Like, have I seen The Hurt Locker? Like, now I'm like questioning if I've ever seen
it. I'm legitimately thinking of, after we're done with Tarantino, reviewing some of these movies that took Best Picture over the Tarantino stuff. Because the Hurt Locker, I have seen it, and I'll hold those thoughts in my back pocket until, because I don't know if those thoughts remain the same, but I definitely wouldn't have given it Best Picture over Inglourious Basterds. I will leave it at that for now.
No, that's fair. I think I have seen it. Oh my God. I can't remember. Like that's the thing, is like I just think Inglourious Basterds is more memorable. I mean, maybe that's just on me.
Considerably.
Like maybe I just need to watch The Hurt Locker again, but like I have nothing against it. I think it's a fine movie. It's just not better than this. Like this was Tarantino's thing. Like he thought he was gonna win Best Picture, and we can get into that later with spoilers.
I think this is the one. He felt it. I think these two movies are the ones that he thought he had the best chance with.
Right.
For either Best Picture or Best Director.
I'm gonna win.
And he came away empty-handed for both of these. And it's not even like Django, where he won a screenplay Oscar. He didn't. He lost to a movie that most people don't really remember from 2009, whereas this is something that people come back to and talk about all the time to this day. So, yeah, Brandon, no, exactly. I will let you start with your grading.
All right, cool. I'm going to pull up my list real quick. It is high. It is very high on the list. Just going to give that as a spoiler. And it is very high because it is the second highest movie we've reviewed so far on this review. It is an A+, 85.7.
Wow. Okay, so that means it's your highest graded Tarantino movie so far.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll get into this later with spoilers. I think there's a specific scene where Tarantino goes, "Yes, this is my best work." And
I'm with you, but I can't go that high.
Sure.
I'm also at an A+, and that was never really in doubt for me. A+, 46.90.
Fair.
So I have this below Pulp Fiction, and I have this below Django Unchained. But
it's below American Beauty?
No, I didn't give American Beauty an A+.
Oh, that's right, you didn't.
It's the only movies that it's below as far as stuff that we've talked about are Shawshank, Pulp Fiction, and Django. That's it.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's
above American Beauty, it's above Reservoir Dogs.
It's probably be a top 10 movie most years. Yeah, it'd probably be a top 10 movie most years of, I would say top five, probably.
I will have to go back and rewatch a lot of stuff from 2009, but at minimum, it's top three.
Right.
Probably top two, could be number one. I think something else might top it, but I would be shocked if it's not at least top two.
Yeah, I just think this movie, for me, is like an all-time. Like, I might change my letterbox and like put this as an all-time movie.
Oh, okay.
Like, see, what I did. It's such a good movie.
What I did was I created something on Letterboxd. You can follow along with us on Letterboxd. I'm just at Mitchell Lee, and I think Brandon too. Your name is just your BT account as well. But I created a list called the Mitchell Lee Movie Appreciation Hall of Fame, and any movie above an 80% A+ goes in the Mitchell Lee Movie Appreciation Hall of Fame. And since I've reworked my rankings back in 2022, only 9 movies are in there. And we've talked about 2 of them being Shawshank and Pulp Fiction. So that means this movie, along with 2 other Tarantino movies, if I'm not mistaken, would be in your Movie Appreciation Hall of Fame.
Yeah, no, they would, which I guess goes back to my whole entire point doing this podcast is, yeah, Tarantino's one of my favorite directors. So it really it makes sense. Yeah, it makes sense. But yeah,
well, this is also why transition. People. Yeah, let's go to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. In case you didn't know, written and directed by Quentin Tarantino. This movie was released in August. Sorry, not August. July 2019. July 26th. The week after what movie, Brandon? What big movie came out before this?
Is it like?
It's a movie where they made a critical mistake, as far as I'm concerned.
A critical mistake.
Yes.
Go ahead. I'm gonna be like kicking myself. It's the movie
where they did "Can You Feel the Love Tonight" at like 2 p.m.
Oh, was it? Was it the Lion King? Like the live action Lion King?
Live action Lion King movie.
Look, I've never seen it, so
you're not missing anything, buddy. Okay, not missing anything.
I thought you were gonna say that that Knives Out was still in theaters by then.
No. Knives Out still had like 5 more months till it was in theaters, but then once it was there for a long time.
Right.
But this came out July 26, 2019, a $90 million budget, and it made $377 million worldwide, $142 million domestically, opened to $41 million, a 2 hour, 41-minute movie about old-time Hollywood making that much money, being a success. It's only going to happen with a director like Tarantino and stars like Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt, and Margot Robbie. And you also got people like Emile Hirsch is in this. And then some of the young stars. Al Pacino is not a young star, obviously, but he's in it as well. But you've got some of the up-and-comers that we didn't really know were up-and-comers at the time. Margaret Qualley's been killing it with several roles. Driveaway Dolls, not really one of them. She was good in it, but the movie sucked. But if you saw Sanctuary or Poor Things, she's definitely a standout in those. So Margaret Qualley, definitely a name to keep your eye out on. And of course, everyone knows Austin Butler. By this point, he's in this. Fantastic in Elvis. Fantastic in Dune Part 2. And I'm really looking forward to seeing him in The Bike Riders this summer as well. But this movie...
Dakota Fanning is like randomly in this movie. She is
a
very awesome role in this movie, but she's like in this movie. Like my girlfriend was like partially watching with me while she was doing something else, and she was like, she saw the credits like roll through at the beginning, and she's like, how many A-list stars he got to do this movie? I'm like, yeah, exactly. He got so Tarantino, many A-list people.
And Sydney Sweeney's also in it in like a nothing role.
Oh, absolutely. So, I was shocked when she was in it. I was like, she was in this movie? I completely forgot.
Yeah, she was in this movie and did basically nothing because this was before people really knew who she was. I think this was filmed before Euphoria came out. So this is, definitely before her star began to really take shape. This movie is, for most people, they knew it as a movie about the Manson killing of Sharon Tate. And, like, yes, but no. You know, Charles Manson's in this movie for about 40 seconds. So if you go in expecting that...
Yeah, I still haven't, like, put that together. I had to put it together this time watching it. Like, I was like, I definitely knew, but, like, yeah, you know, I was just like, eh. That's weird.
That's not really what this movie is about. It's about an actor, Rick Dalton, who's the star of the Western show Bounty Law, or at least he was. And he's kind of an actor whose star is fading just a little bit. And his stunt double, Cliff Booth, as they, at least on Wikipedia here, it says, as they navigate the rapidly changing film industry with the looming threat of the Tate murders hanging overhead. Features multiple storylines and a modern fairy tale tribute to the final moments of Hollywood's quote-unquote golden age. And this movie does reference a lot of TV shows and movies from the day. I will say this movie really made me want to watch Rosemary's Baby, which they reference a couple of times because Sharon Tate was dating director Roman Polanski right after he released Rosemary's Baby, I want to say in 1969. Which, February 1969, was a great time to be alive. Do you know what that is, Brandon?
Why?
Because just a few months prior, the New York Jets won the Super Bowl over the Baltimore Colts. I kind of wish I was alive in 1969 and not any of the years afterwards because, you know, the Jets were Super Bowl champions. It's a good time.
Like, just looking at this, like, cast list, like, Damian Lewis was Steve McQueen for, like, 5 seconds. Like, it's just so
Aya Hawk was in this movie for like 2 minutes, maybe.
Yeah. The Bruce Lee scene always gets me. Like, the Bruce Lee scene gets me.
There were a few people kind of upset about that because they're like, yeah, Bruce Lee wasn't really. Kurt Russell's in this movie for about a minute.
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
Kurt Russell's like a legend. But
yeah, he was like, do you want a minute role in this movie? And Kurt Russell was like, sure, whatever.
I got time for Tarantino, absolutely.
Yeah.
But this is about Rick Dalton, Cliff Booth, and Rick Dalton, DiCaprio. Again, There are people in this movie. Tarantino really gets actors that know how to say their dialogue in a way that it's memorable. Because DiCaprio, mm-hmm. every single thing that he says, it's just, maybe it's just Southern accents in DiCaprio. I don't know. Or in Tarantino. I don't know.
The meme where he goes,
yeah, it's later in the movie, but I just
that's
like
so good
when he's talking to Brad Pitt and he's just like, well, it's official, old buddy. I'm a has-been. I don't know why I made him sound like Elvis, but I mean, you get the point. Yeah,
sounding like Austin Butler playing Elvis, like, I'm a has-been. They don't want me. I gotta do these damn spaghetti westerns.
I gotta go make spaghetti westerns. And nobody likes spaghetti westerns. There's, we'll just get into it now. This is another movie that I saw in theaters twice, and I loved it both times.
Yeah. And, I mean, I loved it.
But here's the thing. I've told you, Brandon, I've said 2019, which I kind of want to just like, I've talked about like, ooh, let's go in on 1999. 2019 is another one of those years that was just it's
such a
man.
Good year. Such a good year.
So many good movies, and they're all so vastly different from each other, too. It was so much fun going to the movies in 2019. And Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was a movie that I was adamant. I was like, this movie is so good. And it's like my number 13 movie of 2019. It's just not going to get on the list. But most years, it would be comfortably in like the top seven.
Agreed. Yeah,
I think it might make the list if I did a 2019 redo, because this movie, Brandon, I liked it a lot more than I remembered, man. I love this movie. And so much of that is because of Tarantino's attention to detail and making you feel like you're in the time. But also, this movie is a giant middle finger to anyone saying, well, stars don't matter in Hollywood anymore. It doesn't matter who you put in front of the camera. It's all about the script, the director, or maybe the cinematographer, but there are no stars in Hollywood anymore. This is a giant fuck you to anyone who believes that, because DiCaprio and Brad Pitt, they have great chemistry with each other, and whenever they're not in scenes together and they're with other people, they elevate every single person that they're in a scene with. There's scenes with DiCaprio and this little girl that he's filming a Western with, and this little girl, like, I don't know why we haven't seen too much from Julia Butters since. Maybe she's just like off being 14 or something. I don't know. But like, this actress was so good and had such good chemistry with DiCaprio that every time that they came back to this Western TV show that they were filming, and DiCaprio trying his best, there's a scene with DiCaprio flipping out in a trailer. And
He goes, you're a piece of shit. You got to get off drugs.
You're a miserable drunk.
Yeah.
Why'd I have to have 8 whiskey sours? He's just yelling at himself because he got to a point in the scene where he was forgetting his lines. And I love this scene where DiCaprio's on the set and he's trying to figure out his lines, and they have to like put the camera back to where it was, and you see them kind of starting over, and it's a really cool way that Tarantino goes about filming this. But he's freaking out in this trailer. And he's yelling at himself, and he's like, you get it together, you piece of shit, or I'm gonna put a bullet in your head. Like, he's just like going off about how much he's drinking, and I practice my lines, and now I don't look like I practice my fucking lines.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just,
you embarrassed yourself in front of all those goddamn people.
right. That's actually a pretty good impression. Yeah, it's just...
The line delivery is perfect.
Yeah, it's just so perfect. And the way they shoot that scene, as you were talking about, they just shoot it so well. It's as if the director would be like, we're so close. We're not rolling back the film. Just say the line. Like, just say it. And he's like, yeah, he's yelling at him. And it's so good. God, I mean, Tarantino makes you feel like Rick Dalton is a true, like, Western star. Like the amount of people that are like, and they make reference to, like, Bonanza and all these other, like, shows, and like FBI.
Green Hornet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like, it just makes you feel like you're in the story, and you're watching this guy fall apart because his acting career just isn't going the way he wants it to.
And he has a conversation with Pacino.
Right.
Yeah. Early in the movie where Pacino was basically like, look, I loved you, man. But every time that you get beat up in one of these TV shows, they don't see.
Right. You're the villain.
They don't see that character getting beat up. They see this other actor being leveled above you. And they see, you know, Jake Cahill, which is the actor for Bounty Law. They see him getting beat. They see Cliff Booth getting beat. And it kind of causes Cliff Booth to have like a existential crisis where he's just kind of breaking down. And yeah, he's another conversation with Julia Butters about this book that he's reading and how he kind of finally realizes that the book is about a cowboy that doesn't quite have it anymore named Easy Breezy.
Right.
It's good stuff.
Yeah, no, it's really good stuff because it's taking like a subtle way of talking about Rick Dalton. It's like all these subtle like hints and like clues to like, this is how Rick Dalton feels. And yeah, I mean the whole pilot, like TV pilot thing where it's like, yeah, I got to get ready for pilot season. And like, you know, I hope I get some offers for pilot season. Like he's like the line where he's talking about, you don't rent in Hollywood, you buy.
Yes. I don't know why I just really liked that emphasis on him taking so much pride in the fact that he owned a house
next to Roman Polanski.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That he owned his house, that he's not just passing through. Whatever reason, that was like a little thing that I just really enjoyed that they kept making references to that. But also, this movie has been, first of all, I will say this right here, right now, and that's why I'm not quite as high on this as I am stuff like Pulp Fiction and Django and Inglourious Basterds. Tarantino, we get it. You like feet.
Yeah, yeah.
We understand. I don't need to see. This was Tarantino at his horniest. This was whenever, I feel like they kind of missed an opportunity. When you have Margot Robbie in your movie, and Margot Robbie is one of the best actresses in Hollywood. I will stand on that. I don't really feel like I'm being bold saying that, but there are some people that kind of hate her. And
you're not.
She's taken some roles recently where I wasn't a big fan of Amsterdam or Babylon, but she's still a fantastic actress. And in this, I think that if anyone has complaints with this movie, it's that they don't really do much with Margot Robbie as Sharon Tate. And I would say,
I agree
they could have done more, but I really think that Sharon Tate has a purpose in this movie. And it's kind of just like almost a love letter to like this sweet individual that was really on the come up in Hollywood and was just like, just kind of happy to be there and look at what was taken away from us type of thing.
Right. Yeah, totally. I 100% understand what you just said with that. I will say, in the middle of watching this, I turned to my girlfriend and was like, I'm trying to figure out why Margot Robbie's in this movie. Like, there is a certain point where you go like, why is she in here? But I think they get to it eventually. And then that's what's key, is eventually you do get to it and you're like, oh, okay, like that's why she's in this movie. But at first, it's almost like, here's the plot with Rick Dalton, Cliff Booth, the A plot. Here's like another B plot. And
that's
then here's
what
Sharon
the movie
Tate
is about.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, again, like Inglourious Basterds, I don't know if we've said this. I think we have, maybe we haven't. Cliff Booth and Rick Dalton don't fucking exist. Those aren't real people. This just people that were made up for Quentin Tarantino.
Right.
And you believe in them. You love watching. There's a scene where Cliff Booth is thinking about something while he's fixing an antenna on Cliff on Rick's roof, and he's thinking back to, well, why didn't I get that gig? And then you kind of see it, and it takes like a 10-minute aside to that scene with Bruce Lee,
right?
Where because there are certain
times where I
definitely
don't think Bruce Lee is as cocky as Mike Mo, like.
Yes, but I enjoyed watching it. I enjoyed watching that whole thing about like they're talking about my fists are registered as lethal weapons. If I get into a fight and I kill you, you go to prison. He's like, anybody accidentally kills anybody, they go to prison. It's called manslaughter. And then they just start fighting. It was a great scene. And then they just cut back to Brad Pitt being like, I understand why they don't want to work with me anymore.
I threw
Bruce Lee into like one of the producer's cars. I wonder why they might not want to work with me anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's this weird thing about like, did he kill his wife? And you never get the answer?
No, you never get the answer, but...
And I that's not even one like the Shoshana thing where I can be like,
but
I have no clue.
Let's just go for, you know, theories. He 100% did.
If I had to lean one way or the other, I would lean towards he did, but I don't have enough information.
I will say, I'm not saying that she deserved to die, that like he should have murdered her, but based off that scene on the boat,
well, let's definitely not say that.
Yeah, I'm not advocating for murder. I'm just saying, based off the scene on the boat, you could tell he was very annoyed, and he had a harpoon gun. That's all I'm gonna say. He had a harpoon gun in his hand, and he was very annoyed. So, makes me think he probably did. But I like to think of Cliff Booth as a nice guy, and maybe it's just a misunderstanding. But
I don't know about as a nice guy, but I liked following him around.
That's a good point. He's not really nice.
I don't really know if he's a nice guy, because he was definitely way too interested in that underage girl. But then he was like,
he was interested in picking her up.
But as soon as he was like, "Well, how old are you?" and she's like, "Come on now," he's like, "Nope, not happening. That's not happening." But then he just kind of. There's a scene where he follows Margaret Qualley's character, who's like this hippie Manson follower, and he goes with her to Spawn Ranch, which is kind of where they're hanging out and where they used to shoot a lot of movies that he worked on as a stuntman, because he's Cliff Booth's stuntman, or rather he's Rick Dalton's stuntman. And, the sequence there, I think a lot of people would describe the Cliff Booth subplot as nothing happening. And it's the Rick Dalton stuff that's important, and then the end of the movie. And the Cliff Booth stuff is just kind of meandering along. What do you think about that? Because I wouldn't agree with that. I think Brad Pitt did such a good job with it that I always found it interesting. And I was always on the edge of my seat.
Yeah, I think the Spawn Ranch stuff is... it's definitely different. Like, it just completely halts the movie and goes somewhere else. But I think it's necessary to, like, his character almost, and, like, the character development. And then you obviously get the tie-in where later on something happens that's the characters have met before and stuff like that. But the most important thing to me is just the dialogue in that scene, the tension that we'll get back to that, because that's really what it is. The tension in that scene from the, like, you said it, like the Manson followers, I guess, compared to Cliff Booth's character. He's like, oh no, like I screwed up by taking her to this place. Like, am I going to die right now?
Yeah,
like,
you get bad vibes throughout this old man, and they're like trying to figure out if, like, you know, they've killed this guy or if they're taking advantage of this guy, exploiting him, whatever the case may be. And you find out that he's in the back, he's fine, but there's definitely weird vibes around here with all these hippie people around, and this guy like punctures his tire, and so he beats the shit out of him.
So maybe he's not a good dude, but yeah.
Until he fixes it, and he fixes it just in time before Austin Butler's character gets back to, you know, check up on him. And, you know, what's funny, I'm looking at the Wikipedia summary for this movie right now, and I think a lot of people who would say that the everything with Cliff Booth before the end is pointless, I would say it's not pointless because it pays off incredibly well. But yeah, I'm looking at the Wikipedia. I kind of use that as like a guide. The first like 2 hours and 10 minutes of this movie take up 3 paragraphs. The next half hour of this movie take up 5.
Yeah.
So in case anyone's watching this movie and the first 2 hours or so, you feel a little bit sluggish or whatever the case may be,
wait for the last 25.
It will pay off.
Yeah.
Before we get into grades, let me just go ahead and talk about Oscars with this one too, because this is another one. Tarantino, man. 10 Oscar nominations, tied for the second most. Joker had 11. The Irishman, 1917, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood had 10. They won two, Brandon. It won two. Brad Pitt won his first Oscar as Cliff Booth for this movie, which kind of felt like Brad Pitt was a little overdue. He's been giving great performances for a long time. So I think that while there were other good performances that year, I really liked Joe Pesci in The Irishman that year. That was one that I almost would have gone Joe Pesci, but Brad Pitt would have gotten my vote for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Yeah. Leonardo DiCaprio was nominated but did not win for his role as Rick Dalton. He lost to Joaquin Phoenix as Joker. My vote that year would have gone to Adam Driver in Marriage Story personally, but I do think DiCaprio was really good in this.
Yeah,
Where would you have gone for those two?
I mean, I think DiCaprio is ahead of Pitt, but it's really, really close. You know what I mean? Like, I think...
Well, they're not in the same category.
Oh, okay, you mean who I would have won? Sorry,
Let me read you the nominees, and you tell me who you would have voted for. All right, supporting actor, Brad Pitt in this movie, Tom Hanks in the Mr. Rogers movie, Anthony Hopkins in The Two Popes, and Al Pacino and Joe Pesci in The Irishman. Who gets your vote?
Probably Joe Pesci or Al Pacino.
Okay, probably. So you're not going Pitt there.
Yeah, I'm probably going Irishman. Okay. I mean, I like The Irishman a lot, to be honest with you.
All right, and best actor, Joaquin Phoenix as Joker, Antonio Banderas in Pain and Glory, Leonardo DiCaprio Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Adam Driver in Marriage Story, Jonathan Pryce in The Two Popes. You cowards, why didn't you nominate Taron Egerton for Rocketman?
Yeah, actually, I will see that movie eventually, Rocketman. But
you need to.
Joaquin, I'd probably go with that, but like this is one of those ones where I think DiCaprio and Pitt both give Oscar-worthy performances. They just wouldn't win an Oscar, in my opinion. Yeah. Is kind of how I would look at it.
But costume design. It was nominated, lost to Little Women.
Yeah, but that makes sense.
Cinematography, it lost to 1917, which, duh.
The GOAT was doing the cinematography for that. So.
Yes. Production design, it did win that one. Sound mixing, lost to 1917. Sound editing, lost to Ford v. Ferrari.
That's a really good movie, too. Oh, my gosh. I forget how good 2019 was.
Best original screenplay, lost to Parasite. Best director, Tarantino, lost to Bong Joon-ho in Parasite. Best picture, lost to Parasite.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even, like, blame the Academy. I would probably pick Parasite over this movie.
Yeah, I would, too.
But I love this movie. I love it. Like, even, and I'll get to it with my grades, even if it's not highly graded as some other films, I think I would come back to this film more than most films.
Not on the IMDb top 250, by the way. So
yeah, that's kind of crazy, honestly. Personally, I think that's kind of crazy. I understand why it's not, but I could see it being on the list for sure.
All right, what's the grade?
This is a good one. I just want to make sure I have this completely right, but I'm almost positive I do because when I gave it, I was like, eh. It's so close to an A+. It is a 99.9 A.
Wow. I'm shocked you did not go A+ with this.
I love it, though. That's, I love it. I probably will go A+ at some point, but right now I just don't think it's on the A+ level. Wow. And I think a lot of it has to do with, I totally agree with what you're saying with the Spawn movie ranch scene and Sharon Tate's plot. I just think there's a lot of like moving parts, and I just don't think it works as well as it could. But I think it's really awesome, and I think the last 30 minutes are really what makes this movie, if we're being honest.
I think that this movie it starts off on such a good note, and it ends on such a good note.
Right, the middle part is just...
I'm willing to forgive the middle part that I also loved, but just not as much. And I also just, again, production design winning, I think that is a fantastic Oscar win, because this movie really makes you feel like you're in the late 60s Hollywood. There's a scene...
100%.
There's a scene where after he leaves Spawn Movie Ranch and all the lights are coming on, and it's just kind of a shot, or rather a scene of different like restaurants or cinemas or things in Los Angeles turning their lights on as the sun goes down.
So it's like changing the night. It's like, okay, we're changing to night.
Yeah, and it's just, I thought that was a scene that wasn't necessary for the plot, but it did a really good job of putting you in 1969 Hollywood, and I really appreciated that, watching that personally. I thought this was going to be a movie where I was along the same lines as something like Reservoir Dogs, where I'm at a high A, an enthusiastic A, but I don't touch an A+. And I left this going, we really sneaked an A+ out of that one. Interesting. Yeah. But this is going to join Pulp Fiction as the other Tarantino movie that I'm higher than you on. It's an A+, but it's we're close, because it's a low A+. I'm at 3.56, so just barely sneaking above that line. But it did get above that line for me, and I'm happy that it did, because let's just go ahead and dive into it. We're going to talk about spoilers. We'll start with this and go to Inglourious Basterds. The ending of this movie is just incredible. The movie starts with you're kind of following Sharon Tate, and she's having kind of a rough night because she's deep into pregnancy, and she just it's also August, so it's hot in California, and she's feeling super, super pregnant.
Hottest night of the year.
Yeah, hottest night of the year. They made a point to say that. And three of Manson's followers are there to Manson was there a little earlier and just was looking for her, someone named Terry, and he wasn't there. So Manson was like, hey, go kill everyone that was in Terry's house. And so four show up. One of them, played by Maya Hawke, goes, I left my knife in the car. Can I go to the car to get it? And then takes off with the car.
Which he takes off. Which, to be fair, I would take off too if it was like, by the way, we're gonna kill,
yeah,
like celebrities. So
not, I mean, granted, you're not going to jail for murder. You're not dying, but you are going to jail for being an accessory to murder. But you know what? There's less time in that. So
yeah,
smart decision for her. I mean, really would have been smart decision just, you know, not get involved with Manson whatsoever. But you know, as far as this goes, yeah, not as bad as some of these other people. Tex, played by Austin Butler. You also have Sadie, played by Mikey Madsen. And Katie, played by Madison Beatty. Mikey Madsen's also in the 2022 Scream movie, which, spoiler alert, seeing her in this made her the most obvious twist killer of all time, because she just looks like a crazy bitch. Maybe it's just because of her role in this. Just, I can't see her and not think of her little speech in the car about wanting to kill celebrities, kill the people that taught us how to kill, and right, we're little piggies,
violence, we got whatever violence. The hell.
Yeah. So I just, and by the way, Austin Butler as Tex, fantastic job. It does not feel like Austin Butler to me. I don't think I'm watching Elvis. I don't feel like I'm watching Fade Rautha. I don't feel that when I'm watching. He's such a talented actor. God, I could just gush about him all day. But they break in, and they break into the wrong house, Brandon. They break into the wrong house. They break into Cliff's house. Rather, they break into Rick Dalton's house, and Cliff is there, and Rick Dalton's listening to music out in his pool, and Cliff is, he just did a cigarette, or a cigarette dipped in acid, so he's tripping balls right now. About to feed his dog, but that acid is coming on in a major way, so he thinks he's hallucinating these people. Tex breaks in, and this is the scene where Brad Pitt won his Oscar, as far as I'm concerned. He's great in this movie, but the end of this movie and the scene where he's tripping out and interacting with Austin Butler, it is incredible. And also, I saw something that was very interesting to me, where Austin Butler has become this massive star. And there's the scene earlier in the movie where they talked about they will kill the older star to elevate the younger one. as kind of like a way to move them up type of thing.
Yeah.
But this movie does the opposite, where Brad Pitt kills Austin Butler, or rather the dog does, because Brad Pitt sends the dogs on him after this fantastic interaction where I remember your white little face and you were riding on a horsey, and you could just tell this guy is tripping balls. And this, you see the dog earlier in the movie, incredibly well-trained, waiting for her food, but also incredibly well-trained in the art of killing folks, and goes at Austin Butler. One of the other members starts running at Brad Pitt with a knife. He just absolutely clocks her in the face with the can of dog food. And it's a brutal scene where Brad Pitt is just taking these people out, smashing faces. Right. It's got this movie, for the most part, nasty. It's devoid of the Tarantino violence that you come to expect until that last 20 minutes or so, where Brad Pitt just delivers the goods as far as taking out these people that, again, it's a fairy tale. In real life, these people went to Sharon Tate's house and killed everyone in the house. And it was just awful, awful tragedy. But in this movie, you get to see them all die. And the girl, Mikey Madsen, playing Sadie, her face is all messed up. And she's got this gun, but she can't see anything because her face is so full of blood and she's all messed up. So she's just shooting it in the air. And she falls into the pool, scares DiCaprio. And earlier in the movie, we saw DiCaprio in a movie where he had a flamethrower and he was learning how to use the flamethrower.
The movie is called The 14 Fist of McCluskey. I knew
it was McCluskey. I forgot the rest of it. Thank you, Brandon. Yes. But again, this is a classic case of, it might seem like useless information now, but it will come back around. Trust me.
Right. Where exactly. You see,
he just gets out of the pool, goes and grabs the flamethrower, which, I mean, I don't know if this thing would have had any gas in it, or I don't know if it would have worked.
First off, I don't think he's allowed to carry the flamethrower in his, like, auto.
Yeah, he might be facing some time for that. I don't know if you're allowed to keep that kind of thing in the state of California, but he just takes it and he just cooks her ass in the pool. And it's a fantastic ending to the movie, except it's not really the ending to the movie, because afterwards, Cliff Booth, he got stabbed in like the hip or something, and he's going off to the hospital. Him and Rick have a good exchange, and you get Emil Hirsch, who plays Jay Sebring, and he's at the gate, and he's talking about, hey, what the hell happened there? Are you guys okay? Oh, you're Rick Dalton. You know, I love Bounty Law. And then you hear Sharon Tate on like the intercom, you know, asking if everybody's okay. And I really think that this is the point where the point of Sharon Tate comes home, where it really is kind of it's like a fairy tale type of thing. Everything ends up all right. Everyone is having just like nice, sweet interactions. There's kind of hope for the future, because you see Rick Dalton talking to Sharon Tate as she comes out, and it's just a very nice ending to the movie. And you don't see that all the time with Tarantino, but with some of these movies, like, for example, Django Unchained, you had Django and Broomhilda kind of riding off together, and it was really nice. You get something like that with this here as well. And I thought that it was the perfect ending for the fairy tale that they were setting out to make here.
Yeah, I think fairy tale, the what you wish would have happened in alternate timeline, like, I really like that aspect of it. And unless you truly, I think the fourth time watching this or third time watching it, I really put it together. Because I didn't go on like online to see like what exactly it was all about and like the plot. But then you start realizing, like, oh, every single character in this movie, except for Cliff Booth and Rick Dalton, is a, like, a real person. And so it's like an alternate timeline, like, kind of like, oh, this is what we wish would have happened. Had like, the Manson family members gone to the house and Like
the wrong
they
house.
Wouldn't have done the wrong house, and man, they stepped into a world of pain. They stepped into the wrong hellhole.
Man, they got it.
Yeah. So no, I think I just, I mean, obviously I like the Tarantino violence, but at the end of the day, it's just the chaotic way in which he takes all of that energy in the last 15 minutes and he builds up to it, and then it's like, boom, here it is. Here's the last 15 minutes. It's going to be crazy. It's going to be insane. And you're just going to sit there and be like, wow, I can't believe that just happened. And then what you pointed out at the end, like, it just reverts back to like, oh, like, come on inside. Like, let's like continue having drinks and like, let's like sing some songs and stuff. It's like, how can you go from like torching someone in your pool with a flamethrower to like, oh yeah, I'm gonna go hang out with the neighbors now? Like, I just don't get it.
I like but the there was one scene where he was like, is everyone okay? He's like, yeah, no, me and my buddy Cliff were all right. The hippies aren't. They're dead.
yeah. Well, they sure aren't. I'm like, yeah, of course they aren't. You freaking buried them. And it's just like, yeah, I just don't. Man, but then he's like, he's so pumped to like finally hang out with, like at the Polanski house, basically. He is, yeah. He's so pumped.
I like how it ended on the tone of like, man, we really lost some really sweet, really good people. And it's a shame that this happened. And I really wish that it hadn't. I thought that it just really, it's a nice ending, but it's also sad because it's like,
that's not what actually happened.
That's not what actually happened. And what happened was much worse. So
yeah. Well, in going to that, like going to Inglourious Basterds and those spoilers, like,
I think there's a little more meat on the bone here.
Yeah, there's a little more meat. All right, let's get into it. Oh, so the movie theater scene where
we're just skipping past the Fassbender scene.
Okay, let's go to the Fassbender scene and then let's go to
Shishka. Well, you don't even have to touch on much, but just hey, you had the you held up the number 3 in the wrong way.
Oh, I just thought that
builds. Yeah. And everyone dies except for Von Hammersmark, the actress played by Diane Kruger. And this is where Brad Pitt comes up with a plan. And no one has talked to each other. We have two separate plans going on at the same time. We have the bastards planning to come in and shoot everyone. And then we have Shoshana planning to come in and burn the theater down. You get this,
the theater up. Yeah.
You get this like interesting lesson and like, this is the type of Tarantino that I like, where you can tell that he is knowledgeable on film, but incorporates it into the movie, where he wanted to talk about how flammable the film that they used was,
and how
a little bit could start a huge fire, and they had a lot of it, so they could really just like mess them up, and I really like, but these two plans are going on, and no one from either side knows the other one is planning anything.
It's a convergence of revenge.
Yes.
Almost onto this one point in time. And yeah, I mean, look, the scene in the bar with Madsen's character is, I mean, as much as we can talk about whether Madsen is good in some roles and not.
You mean Fassbender?
Fassbender. I don't know why I was saying Madsen. Fassbender. I think Fassbender like carries that scene, and then just all the shooting afterwards, and then the dad who's incredible. Yeah, he's awesome.
I don't want to say it's the movie that put Michael Fassbender on the map, because I know he was in 300 a few years before this.
Yeah, but this was
the movie that had people going like, "Oh, I want him in more stuff," along with Christoph Waltz. Let's get some of these foreign people in some big roles.
It's like, oh, he can do it. Like he can act a little bit.
But
like,
the big thing that comes from this scene is, all right, now we got to find a new way to get in to the premiere. Right. And Aldo Raine's like,
kind of means,
shit, I speak Italian. And you're like, how in the fuck do you? No, you don't. You can barely speak English. And then they go into this premiere, and Hans Landa's there, so they got to talk to Hans Landa, and Hans Landa's Hans Landa knows. There's no debate that's, about like whether Hans Landa knows or not.
Hans Landa is he does not give a like he cares but he doesn't care. You know?
He's not committed to the cause. He's committed to entertaining his damn self. And he's just like, let's hear you guys speak a little bit of Italian, please. What's your name? Buongiorno. Gorlami.
Gorlami?
Gorlami. And then he keeps Antonio Margheriti, which I don't know if you noticed. There is a, I think it's in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. One of the directors of what the spaghetti Western that it's DiCaprio was in was Antonio Margheriti. So that's a callback to Inglourious Basterds that I really enjoyed.
I did really like that callback.
Yeah. And then the guy, I love how they're all doing the Tommy DeVito when they're supposed to be Dominic DeCoco. And he's like, excellent job, my boy.
Dominic DeCoco.
That's such a fantastic scene. But at the same time, you got Melanie Laurent, and she's getting things together with her guy Marcel, the projectionist, to blow up the cinema, and everyone's coming into the cinema to watch the premiere for this movie. I think it's called Nation's Pride is the name of the movie.
Oh yeah, well that's a callback to like an actual movie that Hitler released that was like the big propaganda film for the Nazis.
Really,
so,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So it's a real callback, but
Landa kills Von Hammersmark and like wastes no time, like just strangles the shit. And apparently, see, this is the kind of thing where I'm like, Tarantino, damn it, I don't need to know that, and I don't want to know that. And Tarantino strangled the actress herself for that role.
Yeah, that's. I mean,
Tarantino's an odd guy. Tarantino's an odd guy, but after that, Aldo Raine and fucking BJ Novak from The Office as another.
Yudovich is a monster.
The little Aldo, the Apache, and the little man are discovered and taken prisoner by Hans Landa. But then you find out that Hans Landa is just like, look, I have a loyalty to me. I'm not loyal to any of this. I look out for number one. So I know that your guys are in there and they've got guns and they've got explosives, but here's the thing. I don't care if the war keeps going. Cut me a deal. I will not call the cinema. I would have them arrested and taken out in a heartbeat. No, I'd have you killed. No problem. But here's the thing. I don't give a fuck about the Nazis. I care about me. So you do this, cut me a deal. Give me a little property on Nantucket Island. Let me go free. And we'll cut a deal, and you know, full pardon, all that stuff. And they're like, all right, cool, sounds good to me. Except the thing is, no one else knows. And Frederick Zoller, you know, Daniel Brühl, he's like, I'm not really trying to watch my. That was a really fucked up day when I killed all those people. He's kind of, you can kind of get a little PTSD vibe from what he's watching. So he goes up and he's like, well, I haven't had sex with Melanie Laurent yet. Surely this will be the time that it will work out perfectly. So he goes up to the projection booth and he's like, I'm not taking no for an answer. And Shoshana is suddenly just like, nope, not today. This is not happening. And shoots him like three times. But Shoshana makes the fateful mistake, like any zombie, any Nazi, you go for the head and you make sure they're dead, because she goes to check instead of just shooting. And Daniel Brühl comes out, bam, one to the chest, and Shoshana is dead. However, Shoshana has already done what she needs to do, as she has gone to the last reel of her and Marcel shot. It's Brandon. I've watched this scene multiple times since watching the movie. It gives me chills. I honestly think that it might be, I think the only other scene that can compete with it, as much as I love Django, is Samuel L. Jackson at the end of Pulp Fiction, and where he's talking to Tim Roth at the diner. Mm-hmm. I think that's the only scene that can compete with this scene as far as 100%. Tarantino goes, where you get Daniel Brühl, who wants to send a message to Germany? And then it's cut in where they switched out the film and Shoshana comes in. I have a message for Germany. And Hitler stands up and he's like, no, turn this shit off. And he's like, well, Shoshana's saying, you're all going to die. I want you all to look in the face of the Jew that's going to do it. And she says, Marcel, burn this motherfucker to the ground. And Marcel takes that cigarette, pops it over into the pile of film. Cinema goes up in flames, but not before the bastards are coming in, because Dominic DeCoco and Antonio Margheriti still have work to do, Brandon. They go in and they just start
picking off Nazis left and right.
You got the Bear Jew coming in, punching someone in the face with a bullet, basically, in a fantastic death scene. And they go up to, because Hitler and Goebbels, they're in like this, they're like in a box. They have box seats. So like, all right, we're going into that box and we're going to shoot them. And they just start shooting at Hitler and Goebbels. And they're like, all right, we got elevated seats now. We could just start picking people off, even though the doors are locked and the place is on fire. Just shoot them anyway. And you see them shooting Hitler like 20 different times. I think Eli Roth does a great job in this scene selling the anger. Because you hear Shoshana say, this is the result of Jewish vengeance, or something along those lines.
Right, exactly.
Eli Roth, and the look on his face as he is just shooting Hitler like 20 times in the face is one of someone that is aggressively like upset and angry. And I thought he sold that so incredibly well. I don't know much about Eli Roth as an actor. I know he's a director in a lot of movies that I don't really care to watch, if I'm being honest. He does a lot of like the hostile type stuff, so I'm not really going there. But as far as this role, I thought he did a great job. And you also kind of see some scenes of like the screen is obviously all burnt up, but you see almost like a ghost, Shoshana, just in the background laughing as everyone is dying. Oh my! Like Tarantino, job well done. But well, first of all, before we move on, Brandon, any thoughts on that scene? Because I think it was just one of cinema's best.
You summed it up. Like, like her face as the flames are coming around her, and it's like she's like laughing maniacally. I'm like, yeah, I'm like, this is like a great scene. And yes, it's killing Nazis and like whatever enjoyment
you get. Nazis.
Nazis. Whatever enjoyment you get out of that. That's not really like, it's just showing like this is the culmination of like a revenge story, basically. And I think it's just so well done. And then that brings my favorite scene of the movie, the final scene. I'll just skip a little bit. Like, basically Brad Pitt's character, you know, Aldo Raine, is like, okay, like, you cut a deal, Hans, that's cool. Like, we'll give you your, you know, island on Nantucket. Okay, we're going to shoot your, you know, associate partner right here. Yeah, your associate real quick. Like, he didn't really do anything wrong, but, you know, he's a Nazi.
They don't give a fuck about him. They need you.
Yeah, they need you. They don't care if he's part of the deal or not. And he goes, he gives him the same exact speech he gave the other guy. He's like, are you going to take off your Nazi uniform when you get to your little island in Nantucket? And he's like, well, you probably are.
Who knows where this is going.
Yeah, he's like, you probably are, because, like, you know, it's not functional to wear your uniform the entire time. Like, eventually you have to take it off. So I'm going to give you something to remember me by, and we're going to make sure that
take off.
Yeah, I'll give you something you can't take off. And he cuts a swastika in his forehead, and the movie ends with my favorite line, maybe of all time. Aldo Raine goes, you know something, you're the bitch. I think this just might be my masterpiece. And then it cuts to black, and it's like Quentin Tarantino?
Written and directed by Quentin Tarantino.
I'm like, this is amazing. Oh my God.
It might as well have said, like, I was supposed to, might have done like a quote, just like line Quentin Tarantino. Because that was right. Quentin Tarantino saying, you know what? I think this is my masterpiece.
Right. No.
Just telling everyone, I put my dick on the table, measure that shit.
Yeah, my review on Letterboxd is the final shot looking down at the camera, and then, you know something, Yudovich, I think this just might be my masterpiece. Mr. Tarantino, I 1,000% agree. This is his masterpiece. This movie is his masterpiece, and that's why I have it as my highest rated Tarantino film. I think it's so good. I mean, and that line is just him saying, like, yeah, fuck everyone else. Like I went and did it. Like, I made
rarely
it not-
do you get to see a director like truly like acknowledge, like, yeah, this is right. Yeah, right. I did that.
Like, and I made a Nazi. Cool. I made a Nazi hunter movie where, like, it's cool. Like, I made Nazi killing cool, and it's like, yeah, like, yeah, you did. Like, you definitely did.
There's also one of my favorite lines at the end there, where, first of all, Christoph Waltz does an excellent job of selling just like fear and confusion at the end of that.
Yes.
Great job. But he says, "You'll be shot for this," and Brad Pitt goes, "Nah, more like chewed out. I've been chewed out before."
Yeah,
Brad Pitt, every single line that Brad Pitt says in this movie, I don't know if it's the accents, the delivery, the writing. The answer to that is probably yes. Just everything. Gorlami. It's just so quotable.
Gorlami.
Everything is perfect.
Again? Gorlami. Yeah.
Buongiorno. You're just like, oh my God, this dumb motherfucker said he could speak Italian. Why did I believe him?
Yeah, it's so good. I mean, yeah. I just, the balls it takes to basically write that in and then be like, yeah, no one's taking that out. Like,
well, he didn't know. He wrote this movie before Kill Bill, and he was wanting to make this in like the late 90s, early 2000s, but he was so stuck on how to finish the movie. He did not know how to finish the movie. Fair. He said that was the thing that really was giving him trouble. Tarantino, hey man, have trouble more often, because when you're you figure it out, man, because this, I can't imagine a better conclusion to the movie than what you came up with.
Yeah, take 10 years. Take a little break to figure out editing to the movie, because like that was, it's spectacular. Because you think like the movie is gonna end, you're like, oh, okay, like Hans is gonna do his thing, like Landa's gonna get together to Nantucket, and like, you know, the bastards have done their thing, like they killed Hitler, like the war's over now, and then it's like, oh no, we got this like one little special little thing for you.
Just, we gotta take care of Hans.
Good. Yeah, it's so good. Yeah, just one of my favorite movies, honestly. One of my favorite movies.
All right. Well, 3 A+s and an A, and a very high A at that. So if you have learned nothing from these reviews, well, if you're at this point, they've already been spoiled for you. Then sorry.
You know that we're Tarantino guys. Like, yeah. Come on. I mean, yeah.
No matter how much I wasn't a big fan of Kill Bill, this really brought me back around. Please go give Inglourious Basterds and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood a watch. By the way, Inglourious Basterds I got for $4 on Amazon. As soon as I was done watching it, I'm like, I have to add this to the collection. So I went and I already had Once Upon a Time in Hollywood on
DVD,
Blu-ray.
Right? On DVD, right? On DVD, right? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I got that.
Yeah, the Tarantino box.
I love
box.
Tarantino so much. I got the Tarantino box.
Nice.
Which was worth it, but yeah.
Well, that box is going to come in handy, because our next podcast, we wrap up the Tarantino marathon. We've got Jackie Brown and The Hateful Eight as we discuss Tarantino's two most probably under-discussed. And I have Jackie Brown's the only one I have. Actually, I hadn't seen Kill Bill 2 or Reservoir Dogs coming into this. But Jackie Brown, once I've seen that, I've seen all of Tarantino's movies. You will have as well. If you've been watching along with us, you will have as well. But we will review that next, and then afterwards we'll rank our Tarantino movies, and then we're done with Tarantino, man, and we can move on to the next one. Next one might be Francis Ford Coppola.
Coppola.
Might be time to get into The Godfather. Some real Italians, not Not Dominic DeCoco, but some real Italians.
Dominic DeCoco?
Yeah. nice transition. Thank you for listening. For Brandon Tu, I'm Mitchell Lee. Please go watch Inglourious Basterds Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Form your own opinion. Hopefully you love it just as much, if not even more, than we did. And we'll see you next time for Jackie Brown and the Hateful Eight.